Today is Tuesday, December 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a passenger train's very first ride ends in tragedy.
Things just started to tip over and as it was going around, and then all of a sudden just ended up on its side and everything went dark and stuff started flying around, and that was it, and then it stopped.
President Trump outlines his new national security strategy. The U.S. exercises its first veto power in the U.N. on the issue of Jerusalem. Also ahead, the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, an Amtrak train derailed in the northwestern U.S. state of Washington Monday during its first ever run along a faster new route, with some of its cars falling on a busy interstate below and killing at least three riders. This is how it sounded on the dispatcher right after it happened.
BNSF's train dispatcher 501, come in.
Amtrak 501 answering Centralia North, over.
Hey guys, what happened?
We were coming around the corner to take the bridge over I-5 there, right north into Nisqually, and we went on the ground.
Okay, are you, is everybody okay?
I'm still figuring that out. We got cars everywhere and down onto the highway.
Passengers also described the horrific scene.
The one guy pushed out the window and I helped him get down and he helped me get down and we crawled underneath the train. And I could hear people screaming and stuff in the other part. So, and then by that time, ambulances and stuff were coming. So, yeah.
Local officials say more than 100 other people were injured when 13 of the train's 14 cars jumped the tracks. Five vehicles plus two semi-trailer trucks were hit by the train cars. Some motorists were injured, but none died, according to authorities. Joining us now is Herb Krohn. He's Washington State Legislative Director for the Sheet Metal Air Rail Transportation Union that represents these rail workers. What can you tell us?
Well, you know, first of all, we're most concerned about the families of the passengers and the crew. You know, our heart goes out to them, and we want to do everything we can to help them during these difficult times. And I think it's even more difficult because it's happened during the holiday season, and that makes it even more tragic. This train was the first train operating on a newly rebuilt line, mm-hmm. in terms of revenue service. They've been
right.
testing trains out there, but it's the first actual passenger train to run over that line. And it was a reason for celebration. It takes passenger trains, off of the route that moves along Puget Sound under the Tacoma Narrows Bridge and puts them on a more direct route that shaves off, I think, about 15 minutes from the run to Portland, between Seattle and Portland. They've been working on this line for several years.
Have you been to the scene of this accident?
Not yet, but I'm planning on going there hopefully tonight or tomorrow with our organization's representative to the NTSB team.
Well, I guess it's too early to know anything about what might have caused this.
No, there could be any number of things. It could be a combination of things. The NTSB is a very, very thorough entity for investigating these things. It's a very thorough collaborative process between the federal government and the railroad carriers and railroad labor, and they do a really good job at trying to piece these things together and come out with a determination as to the causes as well as possible contributing factors. And they try to look at everything. I mean, absolutely every factor, down to how long crew member the engineers may have had rest, when they last worked. They look at every single aspect. I don't think there's anything that they leave out. They're very, very diligent and thorough. We really don't know that much yet as to why or how or likely cause. And that's why we need a thorough investigation, and no one should be jumping to conclusions without credible evidence as to what happened and how we can make sure it doesn't happen again.
Well, Russell Quimby is a former investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board in the areas of rail operations, train handling, tracks, equipment, etc. He's with us now. Obviously, sir, it's way too early to say what caused this, but given your expertise in these matters, what do you think might have happened here?
Well, based on just the observations of the videos on the news, it looks to me like the train was speeding due to two indicators. One, that there was little or no track damage, and two, the position of the lead locomotive unit. That's the white one in the video that's on the ground alongside Interstate I-5. It looks like it made a straight line off the curve, which is indicative of overspeed. Now, if it is overspeed, then that is an assumption. It was probably due to some form of human error or failure. And that could be generally two things, fatigue, somebody nodded off, or distraction. And we're making assumptions, but that's kind of what the way I see it at this point anyway.
But it, on an inaugural trip, this train's brand new, its very first trip, it seems like it would be unusual for someone to be distracted. It would seem like you'd be extra focused on a situation like that.
But sometimes if you've got other people up in the cab, and I'm not sure there were any, was anybody in the cab with the locomotive engineer, but if there was, or he might have been distracted by somebody, or who knows, even though they're not supposed to and it's against regulations, he might have been on a cell phone or another device, or who knows. It might have been just, he might just have been mentally out to lunch. Maybe, you know, maybe he's having a crisis in his family or upcoming holidays. Could be all kinds of things.
I mean, what else could it have possibly been? I mean,
well, that's what they're going to find out. But one of the telltale things, each of the locomotive units in this train, and there was one on each end, it was a, what they call a push-pull commuter train, so they didn't have to turn the train around at either end. They just, you know, operate from the other locomotive. But once they download the event recorders, that records the speed, and they'll know right away if it was over speed or not.
All right. Well, we appreciate that perspective. Well, there are a number of people in towns where this rail line crosses that opposed the project to begin with, and that includes our next guest, Lakewood Mayor Don Anderson. His city fought against it, even filing suit in 2013 amid safety concerns. So thank you for being with us. Our deepest condolences to your community. You recently actually predicted the new higher-speed train would lead to these deadly accidents.
It's kind of an unspeakable tragedy, especially this time of year. I guess, and the reaction is shock and dismay that such an accident had to occur.
You were against this new rail line, were you not?
Yeah, on behalf of our city, we opposed this from the outset of its stimulus package funding, as very little transportation for a lot of money, creating public safety risk in an urbanized area that was not familiar with rail traffic, and on a line that was adjacent to Interstate 5 and some major arterials that had a lot of at-grade crossings. We politically and legally took whatever action we could to either stop it or provide for additional safety modifications.
What was your reaction when you heard this after this, you know, fighting for this to not happen, and then this very first inaugural ride ends in horrific disaster?
Well, it was shock. It was disbelief. The city manager called me, and when he told me it, Amtrak had derailed, I thought he was speaking figuratively about the project being delayed, not literally going off the rails.
When you were thinking of safety issues, you were thinking more from pedestrian standpoints because of
vehicle traffic. There are thousands of crossings a day in our community on at-grade crossings that really have no history of having to worry about a live rail line coming through. Then its locale compared to the prior route, which was along water, the possibility exists for collateral damage if there is a derailment.
How close is this line to Lakewood? Is it actually go through the town?
The line bifurcates our city, and you have to cross a rail crossing to get across from I-5 to the main part of town.
I'm sure this is not one of those moments where you wanted to have to say, I told you so.
No, it's a tragedy for all concerned.
Mayor Don Anderson of the town of Lakewood, he represents the nearby town of Lakewood. And again, our thoughts are with your community. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. An opposition leader says he could beat Putin in a fair election. Islam thrives in a former U.S. church. The U.S. urges renewed food and humanitarian aid deliveries for Yemen. And the U.S. bars drones over nuclear sites for security reasons. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump warned Monday the country's greatness is being challenged by rival powers, but promised the country would use every instrument at its disposal to ignite what he portrayed as an American awakening.
We face rogue regimes that threaten the United States and our allies. We face terrorist organizations, transnational criminal networks, and others who spread violence and evil around the globe. We also face rival powers, Russia and China, that seek to challenge American influence, values, and wealth. We will attempt to build a great partnership with those and other countries, but in a manner that always protects our national interest.
Laying out his new national security strategy during a speech in Washington, he promised that under his leadership, Washington would not back down. Joining us for analysis, national security expert Jamil Jaffer. So what was your overall take on the speech?
The president laid out a bold new vision for America in the national security strategy. It's a vision that I think is going to create some controversy, to be sure. I think some people will be disappointed in his dismissal of free trade, Republicans in particular. I think at the same time, there will be a lot of Republicans heartened by his vision of an America that leads in the world, leads with strength and determination, does it based on its own values and a desire to, benefit America and Americans.
What do you think is the most controversial piece of this?
Well, I think amongst Republicans, I think this piece about free trade will be controversial. I think among Democrats, I think this sort of very different view of the world that Donald Trump has, sort of America first, and America bold and aggressive in the world, is very different than the view that President Barack Obama had. I think a lot of Democrats felt strongly that Barack Obama's approach was the right one. And so there's going to be some dispute about those sort of points of view.
Is it even possible to be America first when we're in such a globally interconnected world?
Well, look, I think the president describes what he calls an America first policy. At the same time, if you look at it, there's a lot of talk about how we as a nation interact with the world, right? And so I think what the national security strategy lays out about America first is putting American interests ahead of interests of other nations in our own foreign policy. But of course, that's how we've always viewed the world. That's not sort of a new thing. That's a very common view of American foreign policy. The only question is how you actually implement it. And I think when it comes to implementation, what that means for President Trump and for his national security strategy is a bold vision for America leading ahead of the curve, talking about our values and our principles and our goals both economically and politically and militarily, and sort of combining that all into an approach that says we're going to talk about who we are and what we believe, and it's going to be okay to be who we are.
Okay. What about national security concerns regarding Russia? It seems that wasn't really mentioned.
Well, I actually think just the opposite. Actually, I think that there was a lot of discussion about Russia, and it very clearly lays out the case that China and Russia are serious strategic competitors and are real national security threats. And in fact, I actually think it describes Russian efforts to manipulate American views of the world, and it says those are inappropriate, unacceptable, and that America will challenge those around the world at all times. And so I actually think it lays out a very bold vision on China and Russia both, and on terrorism.
All right, national security expert Jamil Jaffer, thanks. Well, the Trump administration wielded its first veto, UN veto Monday, blocking a Security Council resolution that called for the status quo on Jerusalem, and came just 2 weeks after President Trump recognized the city as the capital of Israel and plans to move its embassy there. Ambassador Nikki Haley told council members the United States will not be told by any country where we can put our embassy.
For decades, Israel has withstood wave after wave of bias in the UN and its agencies. The United States has often stood beside Israel. We did not on December 23rd, 2016. We will not make that mistake again.
The U.S. was isolated in the votes, and the other 14 members voting in favor of the text. Draft resolution didn't specifically mention the U.S. announcement, but noted its deep regret at recent decisions concerning the status of Jerusalem. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Russell Stone, professor emeritus at the American University Center for Israel Studies, for a reaction.
Well, this is not surprising within the context of the United Nations, where there's often been near consensus on anti-Israel resolutions. This is one where the United States is standing alone. It stands in contrast to the Obama administration about a year ago not opposing a United Nations resolution condemning settlements.
Egypt's foreign ministry said Arab states, which agreed this month to seek the resolution, will meet to evaluate the situation to determine what their next steps might be. What would they be, perhaps?
I have no idea. The fact of the matter is that United Nations resolutions regarding this have very little influence on the ground.
Turkey says it regrets the vetoing by the U.S. of the resolution. It said the United States being left alone in the vote is a concrete sign of the illegality of its decision on Jerusalem.
Well, this really has nothing to do with legality. It has to do with international consensus on an issue that doesn't directly affect most of those making the decision.
Ambassador Nikki Haley said what we witnessed here in the council is an insult. It won't be forgotten. She said the fact that this veto is being done in defense of American sovereignty and defense of America's role in the Middle East peace process is not a source of embarrassment for us. It should be an embarrassment to the remainder of the Security Council. Who was she aiming that at?
Well, it was just generally an expression of support for President Trump's move to recognize Jerusalem as the capital. Kind of unspecified threats of retaliation are not very meaningful in this setting, I don't believe.
Vice President Pence Monday postponed his trip to Egypt and Israel until mid-January, citing the need to preside over the Senate's sweeping tax overhaul. But is this a sign that perhaps the U.S. will be unable to do anything to advance the peace process?
What had happened was that Palestinian groups as well as Christian church leaders in Israel had refused to meet with him to begin with, so his itinerary was curtailed. So there's a mixture of both. He will be needed in the Senate, perhaps partly as a result of Senator McCain choosing to go home to Arizona for medical treatment.
What happens to the status of Jerusalem now? Does the U.S. Go full bore, setting up the embassy and so forth? Turkey announced that it's going to set up an embassy in East Jerusalem that will recognize the state of Palestine.
Well, I don't think that it won't do anything to change the status of Jerusalem. In fact, even the United States' position is that the status of Jerusalem needs to be decided through negotiation between the two parties. So unilateral moves on the part of the United States or on the part of Turkey won't do anything really to change the status.
Are you surprised France and Britain abandoned the U.S. in this matter?
Well, in the United Nations, in the context of the Security Council, they've tended not to be as supportive of Israel as they are in other settings.
What does this do to the position of the U.S. as really the only quote-unquote superpower who can broker Mideast peace?
Hard to know. It's not an urgent issue, I think, at the moment, because nobody's in a position to broker a Mideast peace. In the long run, it will have to be an arrangement that is acceptable to the two major parties in the conflict, and the extent to which there is broader world cooperation, global cooperation in supporting that, the more likely it will take place. But it's not imminent.
What does this do to our standing in the Arab world?
Not very much, I don't think. It wasn't unexpected. What it's resulting in is some almost lip service opposition to the United States policies, whereas behind the scenes, nothing much has changed.
That's Russell Stone, Professor Emeritus at American University Center for Israel Studies. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's happening in social media. For that, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. What's going on, Andrew?
Lori, last month, Twitter announced that they would be changing their policies on confronting abusive and hateful comments on the platform. And in fact, we talked about it on the show. Well, now they've announced that those new rules have gone into effect. They're cracking down on content that expresses or glorifies violence, racism, sexism, and not just within Twitter. This was the thing that made a lot of news when they announced this. They're also looking at outside the social network as well. So groups or organizations that promote hate or racism, whether it's on Twitter or not, can have their accounts banned. Now, this seems to be in response to a controversy earlier this year where Twitter verified several accounts that were associated with white supremacist groups. So this seems to be the way to counter that and address that concern. Now, it's worth noting that military and government entities are exempt from these rules. Some say that's Twitter's way of allowing President Trump to continue to post content without removing his account. People, of course, have reported him in the past. Another story that we've talked about is how his account was removed for 11 minutes because he had violated the terms of service, and an employee on his last day of work decided to try to remove the president's account. So this seems to be the response to that, that you cannot post content that is objectionable unless you are in the government or the military. Now, Twitter acknowledges this is just the beginning. They say on their Twitter safety blog, quote, "In order to be more aggressive here, we may make some mistakes and are working on a robust appeals process." And they say they'll evaluate and iterate on these changes in the coming days and weeks. So this is far from the last word on this. But it is an acknowledgement from Twitter about the issues on the platform, the issues with racism, sexism, violence, and a big step towards addressing those issues.
Absolutely. Anything else?
Yes. Another topic that's trending is a man named Matthew Peterson. Now, he's a commissioner for the Federal Elections Commission here in Washington, D.C., and he was nominated by President Trump to become a judge on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, which is a pretty prestigious judicial appointment. But at Matthew Peterson's confirmation hearing, he ran into a bit of trouble. He was asked by Louisiana Senator John Kennedy some basic legal questions, and he wasn't able to answer them. Another senator who was at that Senate judiciary hearing, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, put the video clip of this exchange on social media. And you can guess what happened next.
Oh, yeah.
It went viral.
I saw it, and so did everybody else.
I did, too. And, in fact, over 4 million people saw that five-minute clip all over social media.
That would be embarrassing.
It was. And, in fact, it was so embarrassing for Matthew Peterson that he announced on Monday that he is withdrawing his nomination. He said that the viral video has caused enough embarrassment for the administration and himself, and he said he was disappointed that people focused more on a two-minute video than his two decades of public service. But I think this case symbolizes two things, Lori. One, that going viral is not always a good thing.
Right.
And two, that through the power of social media, you can indeed have an impact on things like how the government functions. So for all the social media naysayers, this is your proof that social media does indeed give power to the people.
All right, Andrew, thank you. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. Well, music is a big part of celebrating the holiday season. There are traditional songs that date back hundreds of years and more contemporary music from today's biggest stars. One of the most popular songs year after year was written just after World War II about a reindeer who didn't quite fit in. VOA's Jim Bertel has the story of Rudolph.
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose.
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer is one of the most loved holiday songs in the U.S. and around the world. First recorded by Gene Autry in 1949, it has since been performed by hundreds of singers in many different languages. The song was written by composer Johnny Marks, who died in 1985. He is best known for his many Christmas songs, including Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree and Holly Jolly Christmas.
Have a holly jolly Christmas, and in case you didn't hear, oh, by golly, have a holly jolly Christmas this year.
But Rudolph was his biggest hit. It was inspired by a poem by Robert May. Before his death, he took time to talk about his career. He said he didn't like his first try at the famous song.
Well, I'll admit it would be simpler if I just show you what I didn't like by playing it, because the original tune went, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Well, as I played it over, it just didn't sound like much of a tune to me, and I just didn't like it.
But then, a couple of years later, he started humming a tune on the street, one that would become very familiar.
Well, Well, I think you recognize that, but you'll see it's the original tune in reverse, because the first one went, put it in reverse. At any rate, after I had that opening strain, then I came across...
Mark's favorite part of the song is the opening verse because, as he says, it sets the whole picture for the song.
You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
The song has gone on to inspire a TV special and a feature film. And the song, like the reindeer, will go down in history. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
ISIS may have been largely routed in Syria, but the nightmare of violence and devastation in the country continues in various enclaves, including in opposition-held eastern Ghouta, located on the outskirts of Damascus. According to the United Nations, 400,000 people are under siege there, cut off from aid and medical help. Jan Englund, UN senior advisor for Syria, told reporters that obstacles stopping the delivery of humanitarian aid and carrying out of medical evacuations are resulting in the deaths of children. We need help from parties on the ground, by the Syrian government, by all of those nations who have influence, and they are not helping us as they should, he said. Unfortunately, the Syrian government, with support from its ally Russia, is responsible for the siege in eastern Ghouta, and that includes stepped-up bombing attacks targeting hospitals, markets, and other civilian areas. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert condemned the attacks and continuing siege.
Deliberate tactics to starve Syrian civilians, including women and children, block humanitarian and medical aid, bomb hospitals, medical personnel, and first responders in eastern Ghouta. We consider that to be deeply troubling. The lives of Syrian children and families are not political tools, and we call on the international community to swiftly condemn those horrific acts.
Ms. Nauert also called on Russia to live up to its obligation to uphold the de-escalation zone in eastern Ghouta and to end all further attacks against civilians in Syria.
The atrocities reveal the Assad regime's utter disregard for its own people and the extent to which it will go to retain its grip on power.
Acts such as these, said spokesperson Nauert, clearly demonstrate the need for the international community to vigorously support the UN-led Geneva process for a political resolution to the conflict that respects the will of the Syrian people. They also emphasize the urgent need for unhindered humanitarian access and renewal of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2165 on humanitarian access.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.